Hello, I'm Sebastian Hassinger, and this is the actual 49th episode of The New Quantum Era, despite what I said in the intro for the last episode. I recorded 12 interviews while I was at the American Physical Society's Global Summit, thanks to the space that the APS generously provided me. And with that copious backlog, I've gotten a little mixed up here and there about how many recordings are in the can versus what I've already posted, the order in which I recorded them, the order in which I'm going to release them. So I apologize for any confusion. This is the 49th episode. In this episode, I will be talking with Yonatan Cohen, CTO and co-founder of Quantum Machines, who also provides support for this episode and my interviews at the APS Summit. Quantum Machines was founded in 2018 to build and market control systems for quantum computing and quantum physics labs. On this podcast, we often talk about how hard it is to make qubits, but it is also very hard to control qubits. In a superconducting qubit, logical gate operations are carried out by very precisely defined microwave pulses. These pulses are generated electronically at room temperature, then conveyed down cables into the dilution refrigerator and down to the very bottom, where the qubits are kept at a temperature measured in millikelvins, the so-called coldest place in the universe. Through these pulses, the qubits can be placed in superposition, can be entangled with one another, and can be put through logical operations that change their values, like AND gates, NOT gates, and OR gates. Once the quantum computations are completed, further pulses are used to read out the qubit's state and convey that information back and up and out of the dilution refrigerator, back to room temperature through the electronics, and then interface with the classical computer where the quantum circuit was originally authored. This interaction mediated by microwave pulses defines the boundaries between the classical and the quantum, where the rubber meets the road, if you will. And Quantum Machines' OPX1000 system is designed for exactly this task. As such, they are a strategic vendor to quantum computing hardware companies as well as quantum physics labs in the public sector. In the past couple of years, they've also incorporated NVIDIA's GPUs into their product mix, providing high-performance classical computing resources with very low latency to help with things like state preparation, error correction, and post-processing. My conversation with Yonatan was really interesting, touching on a number of the challenges posed by control of quantum systems, the company's product strategy, their philosophy of quantum control, and a lot more. I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I know I did. Thanks for joining me, Yonatan. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Are you enjoying the week at APS?
Yeah, it's a great week. Very intense. But yeah, very, 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 very good for us. Yeah.
Your booth is definitely the main attraction on the exhibit floor, I have to say. It seems like there's a bigger crowd around that than everybody else's.
Yeah, we went all the way with it this time. We really wanted to kind of show that we are really now thinking very, very deeply how to scale up control systems for quantum.
Right.
And with our approach to quantum control, so we kind of launched a new branding and we wanted it to be done right. Yeah.
The demos are fantastic. I mean, I caught a few of the demos of the new products and stuff. And one of the things I think, you know, you guys have been doing control systems for physics labs, for physics experiments for a number of years, and you started getting deeper into quantum computing as that field started to emerge and mature. And as you said, you're starting now to focus on scale. Scale is one of the critical challenges of quantum computing. It's not just, can you build enough quality qubits, but then can you control that many quality qubits, right? How do you approach that at Quantum Machines? What's your sort of philosophy of control for larger scale systems?
Right. So, I mean, you're exactly right. Scaling up the control system is a challenge. For example, I mean, one important thing to understand is that today the control system scales with the number of qubits.
Right.
So, the bigger your quantum computer is, the bigger your control system is. And it's not like that with every part of the quantum computer.
Right.
So it means a lot. Like, for example, even just the cost of the control system now becomes a big chunk of the entire total cost of the quantum computer. So that's one thing, for example. Our approach, so I can divide it into two parts. First is, how do you scale up the hardware? Particularly, how do you make it more compact? Mm-hmm. Okay, how do you make it, how do you reduce the power consumption per qubit? And how do you lower also the price of control per qubit? Because as we said, the control system scales with the number of qubits. So this is the main challenge, while at the same time, you need to also preserve or actually even improve the analog specification of the hardware, because this is the hardware that drives the quantum processor with analog signals. So the signals have to be very, very accurate. And so doing that while you're pushing the hardware to be denser and, you know, lower cost, lower power, that's a big challenge. So that's one kind of pillar that we're putting a lot of resources and effort and thinking on. And the other big thing is on the digital side of the system, how do you scale up the control, the orchestration of the control system? And that has to do a lot with integrating quantum and classical.
Right.
Okay, and that was kind of traditionally our claim to fame. That's where we started from. We were the first to bring classical compute engines into the heart of the quantum controller with our OPX system. And so bringing classical compute as close to the qubits as possible.
Right.
And now we're taking the next steps. As you scale this up, you need to scale the classical compute power that you put close to the qubit. And for example, our work with DGX Quantum with NVIDIA is all about that.
Right, right. So DGX Quantum is another control device you're adding to the OPX 1000 device, right? It's compatible with OPX?
It's basically a tight integration between the OPX 1000 and the NVIDIA Grace Hopper platform.
Right.
So it's a ultra low latency link between the two, okay?
Got it.
So as I mentioned, we already brought into the OPX 1000 classical compute engines, but there is a limitation to the compute power that
of
we can
course.
Put that close to the qubit.
Yeah.
So now we're taking the extra layer.
Right.
But still, we need very low latency linked to the GPU and CPU.
Right.
And so that's what we developed for DGX Quantum. And together, OPX 1000 and the Grace Hopper and the link between them, we call it DGX Quantum.
Got it. Okay. And that Grace Hopper, that's a lot of compute power. You talked about analog controls. Is that primarily, that GPU, is that primarily involved in making sure that the analog controls of that qubit are as accurate as possible? Or what does it add to the analog control?
Yeah, so we have a few use cases, but I'll mention, you know, the probably two most important use cases for DGX Quantum. What is the GPU or CPU are doing? One thing, as you talked about, is basically shaping those pulses, and that's what we call calibration. So there's a lot of work today on how to speed up calibrations. Again, as you scale up quantum computers, you need to calibrate. So, you know, even for 50 or 100 qubit quantum computers today, you need to spend, you know, I don't know, an hour every 24 hours just calibrating them.
Right? At hardware R&D labs building quantum systems, there's a team that does calibration.
Yes.
And that's a full-time job for a whole bunch of very qualified, trained people. So if you can use that GPU to take some of the time out of that and automate some of that, it's fantastic.
Yes, exactly. And even after you ran the... Even after you develop those calibrations, just running them takes a long time, right? And there is so again, by lowering the latency between classical and quantum, you can do that, okay? And moreover, now there are a lot of works on how can we improve and also accelerate those calibrations and optimization of the quantum computers with neural networks.
Right.
So then, you know, you take the data, you run something on your QPU from the controller. You take the data from the controller, you send it to the GPU, and then you run a neural network there that gives you new parameters for your either pulses or, by the way, also your quantum circuits.
Right.
So this goes all the way also to applications like hybrid, you know, variation algorithms and some things like that. And the other pillar for DGX Quantum, or the other big use case for it, is quantum error correction.
Right.
So there again, you need to take data in real time during the quantum algorithm itself, actually send it to the decoder, and that decoder needs to crunch all the numbers. So you need a lot of processing power, as you said.
It feels like that is the most critical overhead to minimize, is that mid-circuit measurement and look for error syndromes, correct the error syndromes and feed that forward. If you take too long in doing that, it doesn't matter that you're running on a quantum computer at all, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that's just going to completely eliminate any kind of advantage.
Exactly. So there's a very stringent requirements for the latency, and also, by the way, the bandwidth. And then... the amount of classical compute power that you need to crunch all these numbers for the decoding. Yeah.
Right. And so, okay, so let's take the first one first. I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, as you said, the calibration, the bring up, I can see the value of sort of computational horsepower to help with that, to automate it, to accelerate it. But then what's really intriguing is training a machine learning model on the behavior of the qubits. Qubits are very idiosyncratic. Even on one chip, they all have different behavior. On a different day, they might have different behavior.
Yes.
So it does feel like a really powerful use case for machine learning models to help with that, determine the patterns that are maybe too subtle for us to see or too variable for us to be able to manually track and compensate for. So that seems like an extremely powerful sort of, you know, if I can use the phrase that I think that paper that came out, looking at the date at it right now, it's the AI for quantum paper, right? That was sort of a survey paper of use cases for AI for quantum. And this one seems sort of like the foundational one to me. If you can get better qubit control through the application of machine learning, hopefully we accelerate the pace to getting to that productive quantum computer, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to me, that's sort of like the next big step in calibrations and optimizations of a quantum computer, to use AI exactly to predict better the parameters of your quantum system and how they're changing and correct for those changes. We call them drifts, right?
Right.
And so that's exactly right. Like if we can build, you know, models, but also use neural networks to help us really get more accurate predictions of those parameters as well as faster, then we can, so that we can calibrate faster. Because what happens a lot of the time is that, you calibrate your quantum computer, you get some parameters, then it drifts, right?
Yeah.
You cannot just run the calibration again every 5 seconds, because the calibration itself takes half an hour, right?
Right.
But if you reduce the time of the calibration to now take, you know, a fraction of a second, then you can do much more frequent calibration.
You could potentially do it even between circuits you run.
Exactly,
right,
exactly.
Right, right.
And that's something that we've been pushing now for a while. And I think that using, this DGX quantum platform and AI could really impact that, yes.
And I guess, I mean, we're talking about qubit control, but systems are being designed now with like tunable coupling and all sorts of other elements of the system that have analog interactions with the control system. So I guess that machine learning could be applied across all of those elements of the system, right?
Yes. That could be applied. So the way we think about it, we have a model of the quantum system, the quantum processor, but we cannot get a really super accurate model of the quantum processor.
Right.
We try our best to get a model, and then this model has parameters, and we try to fit to these parameters by a sequence of experiments. This is what we call the calibration graph or the calibration workflow, and each kind of node in this graph extracts one parameter of the model of the system. But at the end of the day, we don't even know all the parameters.
Right.
Okay, so that's where you can get extra power from these AI systems, and so this applies to the entire quantum model of your system, whether it's the qubit, the coupler, the readout resonator, or anything that's in your system. Yeah.
Is it also, you mentioned running, you know, optimizing using the machine learning model, optimized circuits? Is it also potentially used for dynamical decoupling, so inserting pulses into idle times on qubits? Like I've seen that using a machine learning model to approach for those as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, you just sort of alluded to, you don't even necessarily know all the parameters because it's happening so quickly and there's so many of them. It almost feels like, especially if we get to error correction and logical qubits, the complexity of controlling, doing logical operations, right? Magic state injection or gate teleportation, all that stuff. It feels like that's going to become even more of a black box interaction between the Grace Hopper, the GPX, or the GPX and the QPUs, right? I mean, that may end up being an incredibly complex sort of real time set of interactions.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that as we progress, I think that it's, there are like kind of like it's interleaved steps where we we have a black box, and then, okay, we figure it out, and then maybe now we have a more simplified model. Maybe we improve the hardware so we understand it better, so we can build a simpler model that's no longer a black box. But then, okay, then now we scale up the system a bit more. Right. So now we need, again, the black box. And so it's right. Also, I think really can help making faster progress
right.
towards building a more robust hardware.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And we've been sort of implicitly just talking about superconducting qubits, but your control hardware can be used in other modalities as well, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I think everything we said probably is really applies to
okay, almost all. Okay, it's just me thinking superconducting.
No, you're right. I mean, we were talking about like the couplers and the resonators,
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
I give some examples from superconducting qubits, but spin qubits are the right. same, right? We have all these elements on the chip. We don't know necessarily all the... We have a model. Maybe the model is not super accurate. And the same for, you know, energy centers,
right.
Atoms,
right.
ions. So, yeah.
It's fascinating. It's a really interesting position to be in as a vendor in the supply chain, that you can supply this stack that is so critical to the performance of the end system, and have visibility across all of these different modalities. So like you're kind of in the catbird seat, so to say, right? do you have a favorite modality yourself?
No,
you love all your children.
And even if I had, I wouldn't have never said it right now. But no,
I didn't ask favorite vendor, just favorite modality. But I understand.
Yeah. No, I mean, actually, it's really interesting. You know, I mean, we work with all of these different modalities, and we see the pros and cons that right. each of them has. So, and it's really not clear which one is going to, right. to be honest, like it's really not clear at this stage. And it's fascinating. I think that most interesting thing is to see how you can sometimes carry like an idea that someone had in one modality right. to a different modality.
Right.
And that is not a trivial thing to do sometimes. I mean, the idea is maybe trivially transferred.
Right.
But the community is sometimes different, right?
Yes.
So these are different people. And like when you see a cool idea that can be applied to a different platform, I think that's a really interesting thing to
me. Yeah, I mean, I think the most recent, like clear example was the logical qubits experiment that Misha Lukin and Vuletic did in the end of 2023, I believe, on a neutral atom platform.
Yeah.
And that approach with transversal gates and LDPC, you can see clearly reflected in the IBM QLDPC paper and the approach of a chip that they're working on, and just the rise of LDPC across the quantum community. It seems like it came from that experiment. That experiment probably was inspired some other experiment as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think that it also kind of shows that we are making the right progress in the field, because you can start, this is a great example, because the fact that you can carry these ideas that are kind of a little bit higher in the stack, like the quantum error correction codes and right. so on, between platforms, means that we're finally getting to a stage where you can really start abstracting those systems in some sense, right? And do similar things on different platforms. Yeah, I think it's happening, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, that was all sort of AI for mostly AI for quantum. On to error correction, you mentioned, you know, the central role of the Grace Hopper, the GPU, in error correction on your platform. I suppose the QPU needs to be able to support mid-circuit measurement and feed forward as sort of as a minimum for implementing error correction, right?
Yeah, the controller needs to be able to do that. Okay. So the QPU is, okay, where the qubits are. And also the QPU actually needs to have a certain structure, like the certain parameters that support right. the mid-circuit measurements, because, for instance, you want to read out your qubits very fast for right. that. So, yeah, all the way down to the QPU, you need to support it. Then the controller needs to have this capability. The controller needs to be able to measure and then based on this measurement do something. And now with the extra decoder also take those measurements, send the results to the decoder, get the result back from the decoder, and then make a decision on whether or not to apply a certain right. feed-forward operation. So you have to have that in the controller, and now you have to also have this communication channel between the controller and decoder.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. Okay, so... Is there also, I mean, you know, there are error correcting codes, the surface code or you know, all of our favorite codes from the error correction zoo. Is there also a role of the GPU in a machine learning kind of way as well, like there was on sort of the calibration and control side?
For error correction?
Yeah.
So there is a growing body of works about on implementing decoders using neural networks. And that actually, I think it's very important because, you know, some of the early decoders, like if you look at minimum weight perfect matching, which is the classical, you know, decoding algorithm for surface code, she's the best decoding algorithm for surface code, but it's very, very heavy in computation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you would need like a very large, high performance computing system. Probably you need to build your own ASICs just to do right. this algorithm. Right, and so it doesn't scale well with the number of qubits in your code. But now, so there are all these works about alternative decoders that are based on neural networks, and those potentially could give you faster decoding time or less computational power for a given decoding decoding task. And this is
Naively, is it a matter of the neural net recognizing patterns within the error correction code and sort of pattern matching and saying, I've seen this before, I can decode it to this without actually doing the exact calculations?
I have to say I'm not an expert on this algorithm. I don't want to say something that that I'm not sure of.
But, naively, does that sound right?
I think that, maybe. I mean, probably there are some patterns that are being
right. So I mean, the other thing that I think is really interesting about your product strategy, you have to at this stage be very open, and this is, I feel like from my perspective, this is probably you know, your roots in the physics labs, right? These are experimental use cases where you don't really know what your end user in the physics lab is actually going to build and what they're trying to measure and how they're going to try to measure it. So you had to build very versatile, like a toolkit really for physicists. And you can still see so much flexibility in the quantum machines stack. Like Qua, for example, is your sort of low-level control language. And you can actually send like executable code to your control platform, right? And have it execute sort of very close to the qubits when that's appropriate for what you need. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, and the GPU itself is also this very heavy compute power for in a general purpose kind of way. Anything a GPU can do, you can try on the platform.
Right.
So over time, you mentioned ASICs. Do you think as the technology matures, and let's say a few winners start to emerge in qubit modalities, do you anticipate sort of hardening or stiffening sort of the product strategy so they'll be like, this is an ASIC based high performance, you know, for this specific type of qubit with these characteristics?
I think so. I think that there is no way out of it. As you said, there is really some consolidation of the technology in the market, not necessarily to one particular architecture or the other, but probably a few that will dominate, right? And that will actually be able to scale up faster than the others. And I think then, yes, we would need to make the control stack a bit more specific to those, because as I mentioned, you want to lower the price per qubit control, you want to lower the power, make it denser, and solve all kinds of problems that if you can kind of harden the requirements, then you could do. But even then, by the way, I think that for us at Quantum Machine, it's very important to keep the, okay, so you can harden the requirements, but you can still keep a very good software interface to your system. And that's key to us. So I mean, you mentioned, you know, Qua and CUDA. And so the fact that you can program now your entire quantum error correction protocol, for example, in Qua and CUDA, all from software, and you get the latencies between the decoder and controller okay, this is huge. This is something that, you know, I think that sometimes people in the field miss a little bit just how important it is. Because you give the users so much flexibility and then the speed of development is just way faster. And, you know, let's be honest, we are still at the point where we're changing the decoding algorithms every time. You mentioned LDPC, because we were changing the entire quantum microcrushing scheme every day, right?
Yeah.
So we need
there,
this.
There may be new ones coming, too. We don't even know.
Yes. So I think that before you go ahead and make an ASIC with a specific decoder, for example.
Right.
Then, you know, once you define it, you cannot go back,
right?
And you need another ASIC. So the fact that you can do it all from software, at least at this stage of the game, is big. And then, later on, we will have to make things more specific as things consolidate.
Yeah, and Quantum Machines also built and operates the Israeli Quantum Computing Center, right?
Right.
In that center, you're providing access to Israeli researchers and others to devices that are either from vendors, but you also like built your own with a chip from Quantware and your own stack, your own control stack, right? So you've essentially built a research device for that constituency.
So that's the Israeli quantum computing team has done that. We sort of run it like almost like a separate company. And this is a research system that we, together with partners, we set up together. Yeah, and it's as you said, it's a research system. It's not meant to be, you know, a full stack high fidelity quantum computer. It's mainly for researchers to get the access to all the layers of the stack and be able to really explore different things. And we give access to the community both in Israel but also to everyone internationally. So.
I just imagine that kind of, and I understand it's its own organization, it needs to be run, you know, as an entity unto itself. That being so close to the quantum machines sort of product team and the business itself must give you so much direct sort of insight into how the researchers are interacting with the devices and with your control stack.
Oh yeah, a lot of what I think a lot of the, you know, product definition came out of the true understanding of how our customers are using these products. So in the early years when we didn't have the IQCC, we just work very closely. We still work very closely with our customers, and most of the inputs to the product come from that. We have a big customer success team, which is really like we try to really engage the closest that we can with customers. And then, yes, once we had the IQCC, it really helped us to have a very tight, closed loop between our R&D, our product teams, and the team that works on calibrating those qubits. And only then we realized, there was a few things that we realized only when we started calibrating qubits, that this is what you need. Yeah.
once you had to do it yourself, you realized this is a pain.
Yes, exactly.
Again, back to sort of looking ahead to when modalities start to emerge that are leading to potential real world quantum advantage, let's say some sort of commercially viable solution for a customer. Do you foresee having to do, I mean, there'll be sort of the end-to-end solution is going to include classical compute, quantum compute, and classical compute on the other end, most likely. Do you sort of see having to do, you know, the way that Grace Hopper is really tightly integrated to the OPX, do you sort of foresee having to integrate the broader classical compute infrastructure into your control system as well?
Yes, I think that's something also very important. So there, you need this very low latency communication for things like quantum error correction and certain calibrations. But I believe we also need to integrate into the entire kind of data center network or HPC network, the more general network, not this really low latency one, so that you can start running very large quantum classical workflows on the entire thing. And this, again, also it has two stages. The stage where this is done for optimizing quantum and scaling up quantum computers. But hopefully there is a smooth transition from this to now we have this data center with the QPU integrated, and the QPU starts giving us extra computational power, which is what we're all hoping for.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's interesting in and of itself, but yes, I hope there's extra computational power in the future. Well, that's really excellent, Jonathan. I think what you guys are doing is really fascinating. As I said, I think it's really rare and unique to have such a broad oversight of all these different modalities. And the fact that you're able to leverage sort of learning across those different experiments is really, really fantastic. So any last thoughts of what the next year quantum machines, what you hope to see happen?
I just hope to continue to work with more and more customers that are leading the field. And this is the thing I enjoy the most, really being there in the labs, seeing how our customers, work with our systems, give us feedback. That's what I hope to do more and more this year.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it.
That's it for another episode of The New Quantum Era. Thank you for listening. The podcast is a production of The New Quantum Era, hosted by me, Sebastian Hassinger, with theme music by Omar Costa Hamido. You can find past episodes on www.newquantumera.com or on Blue Sky at newquantumera.com. Thanks again to support from the APS and Quantum Machines for this episode, and thanks, of course, to Jonathan for a really enjoyable conversation. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe and tell your quantum curious friends to give it a listen.